things. They just don't want nothing to do with anybody anymore. And I feel that the state, being the all natives are of the state, that our state people that we voted for to put in office should say something. Not let more fight go among our own people. I'm also sad to see that Coots Nahoo and Chiac are fighting amongst each other. I'm also a shareholder of Coots Nahoo. The reason I'm denied this award, which is supposed to be given to the people, was because I belong to Coots Nahoo. The reason I belong to Coots Nahoo is my wife signed me up for Coots Nahoo. They told her if you don't sign him up, he's going to lose all his rights, anything to do with the land, subsistence, which is rightfully ours. I was in Germany on border patrol in the service when the land claims was being signed out, the papers being filled amongst all the natives. This is when she signed me up. When I got out of the army, 74, I made inquiry trying to transfer. Not because of being with other different natives, it was because I'm an Aleut. I thought it would be right to be in my own corporation. I was turned down on this also. I don't want to try to get out of Coots Nahoo. It was just, people are proud of what they are, heritage. I've taken my case to an attorney, spent it over $1,000, nothing. Not even a word from anybody. There is a lot of this happening all over amongst the natives. It seems that the people from someplace on the outside are making the natives fight with each other. You got the Chiac and Coots Nahoo fighting with each other. They got the Aleuts, just a few, 17 that were denied in St. Paul, and under 8, and I'm one of them that were denied from St. George. Many of us left home to go to school in Mount Edgecombe, and that threw many of our lives off track and I was also drafted out of the high school. I didn't have time to go home. There was no need to because I had to go in the army. I stayed down here. And that was because of this. I lost all my rights of trying to get into corporation, the Value Corporation. No word ever getting from our representatives and senators in Alaska. I'm trying to get an attorney. It seems that nobody don't want to touch it since it's coming even so close to an election year. They don't want to get themselves in hot water or something. I didn't come prepared for anything like this here to present this to the people. I read it in the paper and some people talking in the streets, this in post office, that a lot of natives are mad and hurt. And they would see like a better change and not fighting amongst their own people. The natives of Alaska should stand as one, not fight with each other. I think they can get together without bringing any Caucasian into a meeting and talk and settle all this dispute. There's no reason to bring anybody on the outside. If the Coots Nahoo and the Chiac could get together. There's a lot of bad feelings on this too. I don't like to see brother and sister fighting with each other. A lot of people are hurt. I've seen not just here, but also in Angoom. People are hurt. There are a few people there that don't like it either. They're not all standing. They don't like fighting with each other. I think the state of Alaska should say something instead of telling the native people that the Settlement Act's got nothing to do with the state. The state is the natives, also is anyone. I just wanted to come and say my piece on docket Court of Claims, U.S. Court of Claims dockets number 352 and 369A of the Pribilofs. The federal government obligated themselves when they gave the people, all the people born before 46, this money. This money was promised to the parents and the children of the parents that would get the money. And I'm being denied because of not belonging to the Aleut Corporation, when this has got nothing to do with corporations. I want to thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Merkuliev.
Honorable Berger, the testimony I mentioned last night that I to save for tonight is basically the same as what I gave last night on behalf of the Klinkenhaida history. But in addition to that, I would like to mention a few things that is not included in this testimony. One is that the Klinkenhaidas had no blood quantum. There was a question as to the authority of wherein did the authority lie to establish who is an Indian and who is not. What is the basis used for saying who is an Indian and who is not? Is it an ethnological thing or is it a legal thing? And Congress took upon itself to insert in the Land Claims Settlement Act 1/4 blood. A lot of us knew that some of our 1/8, 1/16 Indians considered themselves Indians, were accepted by the tribe, but the decision of who is to be an Indian was in the hands of the secretary. His decision was final. There are many affidavits that I took care of myself to include a number of our native people that missed out on the enrollment because of blood quantum. There are others that have missed out completely because they felt that they were enrolled because they signed up with the Klinkenhaidas at one time. I'm talking about the ANSCA enrollment. I'm sure that there are a number of people here that can testify to the fact that they missed out on the enrollment and would have been locked out forever if it was not for my intervention to help them out. The effects of ANSCA, I think, is probably one of the most detrimental things across the nation. For one thing, when I traveled to Washington, D.C., the congressional attitude of a large amount of money, supposedly $1 billion and 40 million acres, given to the Indians, is brought up before us time after time when we seek some benefits that is rightfully ours. There are other Native Americans that has this same attitude toward the Alaska Natives. We know that the lower 48 Indians have been fighting for their land for many years. There is really nothing compelling Congress to act in their behalf because there was no pipeline to be built. I believe the Alaska oil pipeline was one of the main factors to rush this bill through Congress. I have a lot of misgivings about the Land Claims Act, like I mentioned last night. It is not, in my mind, a just and equitable settlement. It has so many ambiguities. Even the writers itself do not accept the entire thing. The state of Alaska does not accept it, neither does the natives accept it, and I find that some of the courts don't even accept it. How can it be called a settlement? I'd like to speak a little bit on the clause that is put in there to give the life of the Indian Allotment Act 2 more years after the enactment of the bill. The Indian Allotment Act was supposed to have given the Indians 160 acres, and they allowed 2 more years after the enactment to apply for 160 acres. It's a phony law as far as I'm concerned. You can see from the record itself that the Bureau of Land Management will reject it on the grounds that the presidential order was in 1910 and the adults born after were too young. I give an example of Mr. Gerald Thomas's father, born after 1910, applied for land that he used and was not able to get it, was rejected. A number of, a whole list of people were rejected in their applications. And those people that have applied are people that have used it from time immemorial. There are certain things that prohibited the natural use of their lands. For one thing, education laws were becoming effective. Families were threatened with the loss of their children or going to jail if they took their children out of school to go camping to put up food for the winter. In them days, there were no food stamps. There were no welfare payments. The Indian had to fend for himself by a subsistence use of the lands, drying fish, smoking fish, putting up seal oil, getting seaweed, various other things that was a natural part of their diet. And along comes the state of Alaska and the section of the Alaska Constitution states that they will not claim anything. I think it's section, Article 12, Section 12, that says that the state of Alaska and its people will disclaim any rights to hunting, fishing, and lands that the Native claims. Now, section is still in the Act, in the Constitution of the state. Now, the termination of the Allotment Act, there are certain things that I have misgivings about. For one thing, it is when you make an application, they tell you it cannot be used for agricultural purposes. It has no indication to be used as an agricultural purposes. Remember, we're not farmers. 160 acres is what we're entitled to. I think a good case was Frank Kitka's case that was in Deep Bay. He applied for his land, and the first rejection, the Forest Service had influence on it and said that he was not using the entire land, and therefore he rejected the 160 acres with the exception of 1/5 of an acre. I helped him appeal that, and finally it brought it up to 4 acres. The final decision went to the Secretary of the Interior. It so happened in the last appeal, I wrote a number of affidavits to be signed by various tribal leaders. One of them was my dad, the other one was Charlie Joseph, another one was Alec Andrews, another one was William Peters. These were elderly people that have known the lands and that it belonged to Mr. Kitka, and that he had used it from, and his family had used it from time immemorial. And yet, these claims was rejected. Mr. Kitka's older son is sitting here in the middle front seat, Mr. Herman Kitka. I don't know how many acres he finally wound up with, whether he got a full acre or not, 4 acres, that was the final, okay. Now this is the type of a thing that we have faced all along. And Mr. Kitka's, Frank Kitka stated that the entire bay belonged to him, that he used it from time immemorial to get crab, clams, he used selected wood to dry his food, he had trap lines along the shoreline. It was not limited to the 4 acres offered to him by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Bureau of Land Management. There's other things that I could probably talk about and spend a lot of time here. There were individual losses that were serious as far as the Native families and individuals are concerned, especially here in the village of Sitka. I am more familiar with the losses here in Sitka because I had direct contact with it. For one thing, we had a large war effort in the Sitka area with the building of Mount Edgecombe. The island over here, Japonski Island, Tatrian Island, Charcoal Island, was all claimed by the various families of Kiksadis, Kakwantan groups that live in Sitka. Now, incidentally, I would like to mention the fact that I am not a Sitka Indian. I am from Angoon originally. I am of Dutch-Awadi Killerwheel tribe. Now, I speak my language. I understand my culture pretty well. And I think I recognize the Indian custom as law. The losses in the village began to be prevalent as far as my own thinking is concerned when the war effort took place. To give you an example, I guess to mention a name again, Mr. Charlie Dick, during the war effort, heard some heavy equipment machinery outside his doorway, and he lived down here next to the Conway dock. When he looked out the window, he found his smokehouse, his woodshed, and outhouse being pushed overboard. And the poor Indian went out there as best he can to tell them that that's his buildings. The naval officer told him that this was for war effort. Being patriotic, he says, I want it back after the war. When the war was over, the Bureau of Land Management sent us a plaque and put on the wall. It's still on the wall of the A&B. I'm sure it's in one of the little rooms right now. It had a life of nine years. If it was not protested within that period of time, it would stand as it is. 3 months after the deadline, we found out that that clause was at the bottom of that plaque. People got excited, got a hold of Charlie Jones, who was the realty officer of the Bureau of Indian Affairs at the time. We asked about Mr. Charlie Dick's property. We found out it was deeded to the adjacent property. It today is worth millions and millions of dollars. It's a fish plant. Mr. Charlie Dick received nothing. Another one was this piece of strip of land down here. A boat shop owned by George Howard, and his home was attached to the building. It was nailed together. It was one building, and he used the IRA monies to build that boat shop. He was an expert boat builder. During this survey, his property was erroneously deeded to the Pyramid Fisheries. When we inquired about it, of Mr. Charlie Jones, says the deadline date is passed. The only way you can get it back is through court action. At that time, there was no money, no way. No, people knew, didn't know what to do with it. We worked on this for quite a number of years. I worked through Joe McGee and the Central Council. The family was finally given a deed to the house, the living quarters portion of it. But they did not receive the boat shop part of it until about 2 or 3 years ago. Oh, these are the kind of things that have taken place within the Indian village. When the land attorneys was asked on these types of losses that were suffered by individual natives and families within the Indian village. Like I mentioned last night, we were told the land claims was a general claims that other legislation or action would seek remedy for these losses that occurred. So it was assumed that sometime in the future these things would be addressed. The closest thing I have ever seen to taking care of this type of losses was the statute of limitations. which had a life of 10 years, I believe it was, and when the time was about to expire, they asked for a 4-year extension. I think they got 2. The 2 years expired, they had an additional 2 more years with the provisions that no more new filings would be made. Now, under the statute of limitations, probably what, 7 or 8 years ago, I filed a claim on behalf of the group through the local Clinton Hata chapter. It was signed by Isabel Brady. It was filed with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs was very lax as far as the action is concerned on trying to remedy these claims. Inquiries brought no response, and finally they came out at the National Congress of American Indians. And this law covers the entire United States. They finally said that they were never funded for it, and that's the reason that they could not do a thing with it. But when they did respond, they say that the claim has no merits, that others have already had claims to it. The act goes only to third parties, like the state or the city or private business or individuals. The federal agencies are exempt. The Bureau of Land Management is exempt. National Park Service is exempt. And other federal agencies are exempt from this claims under the statute of limitations. And that's a very, very hard part of it. The whole situation, I think, would fall on the laps of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, with a big part shared by the Bureau of Land Management because of the way they dealt with the Native people. I don't know whether he did volunteer work or not, but he accompanied the surveyors through the village and pointed up the alleys, this belongs to so-and-so and so-and-so all the way through. And they came out with the plat and they find that this is the way it was, and James Howard was right. But the properties along the shorelines, and you'll find it, and you take a look at those plats, you see the shoreline is curved. You'll find the land that is given to the white man was straight out. Where there was a curvature in the shoreline, and there's a white man sitting here, a white man sitting here, the Indian land tapered off to nothing because of the curvature of the shoreline. Take a look at that plat, and you'll find that this is true. These are the kind of things that we've been up against as far as equal treatment is concerned. I know that a lot of the veterans from World War II received lands along the Halibut Point Road. These were taken under the martial law by the United States Armed Forces. Alaska was under martial law, and they were ready to take anything that they needed for defense. And as a patriotic person, I agree along with that same concept. A lot of our men that went to war had lands within the village. I mentioned a few of them last night. There's quite a number that lost their land during this survey. They drew the line back of the Indian village just as close as they can get it to the village and hemmed us all in. Those lands in the villages that were sold, that were restricted, was not a good sale. Charlie Jones began to travel to Sitka and says that you must apply under the Statehood Act for your tideland. The one, if you have a house on the beach side of tidelands, you must apply to the city within 60 days. And if you don't, it'll be deeded to the city of Sitka, and the occupant must pay an annual lease to the city. So we got busy on that particular item. In addition to that action, Charlie Jones, the realty officer from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, began to point at the old abandoned buildings within the village and said that they were dilapidated and public nuisance and that some children playing in them would get hurt. Some of them were burned out and could not be rebuilt because of the city's code. A basketball team by the name of Nighthawks, with Herbie Hope as the leader, Frankie Benson, Frank Sam as part of the team, were the group that volunteered to tear down these houses. Mr. Walter Gray was the foreman for outside foreman for Sitka. His son, Herbie Gray, was a driver, city trucks. The city donated that truck to haul away unburnables with a stipulation that all burnable lumber must be burned on site, nothing to be salvaged. Now this was done. Now after this was done, it created a number of vacant lots. After the vacant lots appeared within the village, Charlie Jones said that along with the tidelands, you have 60 days to apply for those vacant lots or they will be deeded to the city of Sitka. And these properties must be deeded to one individual, regardless of family holdings. It must be deeded to one. The A&B hall could not be deeded in the name of the A&B. It was deeded in the name of Albert Davis, the president at the time, and he is the trustee for that property. We've suffered with these things from time after time. Charlie Jones used state laws to transfer tribal property, and this is a big thing as far as my mind is concerned, because our ancient customs and ancient practices are much older than the United States government and its constitution. Much older. And this is things that are cherished, things that are practiced. In order to uphold your tribal stature, you had to practice your payoffs, you had to practice your potlatch, you had to do certain things, say it in a certain way to certain individuals, and have it done in appropriate manner, appropriate time and place, and appropriate amounts. These were laws that governed our people. These are laws that are still practiced today. The 1904 that was mentioned, potlatch in Sitka, was supposed to have been law last because of they tried to discourage the practice of old custom. They've even tried to do away with the language. Fortunately, I could speak it fluently, and I will continue in that manner. My younger boy is picking it up and learning the customs and languages. I keep emphasizing that our way of life is laws. It cannot be legislated away. I feel very strongly on that point. It cannot be taken away. The United States government is much stronger than we are, but it does not give them a right to eliminate a weaker nation. Probably should limit what I'm saying now. Others, I'm sure, want to testify, but I know I could speak all night. Thank you. Now, this is for your copy.
Justice Berger, my name is Gerald Thomas. I'm a shareholder in Sea Alaska and Siatka Incorporated. I feel, as the song goes, that we got the shaft under ANSA, because at one time, when I was a little kid, I used to go hunting and fishing with my dad in every bay, every bay, every island, we had smokehouses on them. Today, we don't even see those things. You have to get permission from the Forest Service to use that land. And that land belonged to us at one time. I think it's the greatest loss to the native people in southeastern Alaska that owned all this land. We never argued over the land. It was used under clan and mutual understanding by all people. And we're, I believe, the first environmentalists in the state of Alaska or across the nation. We're taught not to waste food by our parents, our grandparents. We always took care of, when I was growing up, my dad always told me, leave some for tomorrow. So don't take more than what you have, what you need today. These type of things, that's why I always laugh when I read about the environmentalists and the laws that they create to down, to fight us. They taught, ANSA has taught us to fight each other. And I believe the corporate, for 1991, I think the regional corporation and the village corporation should open the rolls to those born after, because I think it's an injustice to all the newborn kids to lose their heritage on a piece of paper written, an act written that they do not understand. The people that read the act or wrote it, I don't believe they understood what they done to us as Native people. And it really hurts me to say I don't believe my grandfather, our ancestors, fought for this type of thing to be pushed into the corporate structure. I'd have been happy with 160 acres of land to say, hey, this is what will belong to my grandchildren. Those things I look at today, and I believe strongly in my heart that our grandparents didn't look, instead of being without land. Every time you look in a paper, see Alaska says, well, we lost 28 million this year. This year we got 4 million. That hurts us natives looking for work. They did not, the regional corporate structures did not create jobs for us in the village or urban areas. We have never, they created a few jobs, but you take a dozen people in the whole that belong to all of Sea Alaska that don't amount to much when they only make 4,000 or 5,000 in a seasonal job. And I think the corporations should be training native students that go to college to take over these corporations. They aren't doing it. You haven't have yet to see Sea Alaska take a college student and say, hey, we're going to train you to be president of this corporation or any of our, we've created jobs for lawyers across the state of Alaska under ANSA. As a lawyer's million-dollar dream that we created, we don't create jobs under ANSA for our own people. The only place we've got jobs in Sitka is through the IRA Council. I haven't worked for 9 months. If it wasn't for IRA Council, I wouldn't have a job today. These type of things are happening to us with Siatka fighting, with Kootsnahu. I don't know when they'll create jobs for their shareholders. And I don't know if my grandchildren, if I have any, will share under Siatka Incorporated, or how long is the money corporation's gonna last. Those type of things we're looking at. Today, we face those problems. I thought everybody had dreams that once we got Sea Alaska going, boy, we're gonna be all millionaires. Today we don't, our elders suffer. They suffer from living on Social Security, those that can get it. The rest have to go on welfare because they've never had Social Security, or things like that are happening to them across Sitka and probably in all the villages too. You see hardship, the high price of electricity, the high price of fuel, and those things really hurt when you start looking at the elders that fought for this, for the land claims, for the Klinkenhaida settlement. And I believe that ANSA should turn around and start, the regional corporation start training the kids that we send our kids to college. They come back, well, sir, we don't have a job for you. Those things are happening daily to their kids that go to college. Today, I do not see any Any of our local kids working in Sea Alaska? I don't see, I was in Juneau in March, and they had a conference over there under, I forget the name of it now, it's Rural Cap. You look at Rural Cap, you see all kinds of lawyers sitting there representing the native people across the state of Alaska. That the board of directors talked, but the lawyers were telling them what to say. And I don't believe that's the way things should be run. I believe that the native people should have the right to say what they want to say in their corporate structures. And those things aren't happening. Today, get on Sea Alaska board, you'd probably have to spend $25,000 of your own money to get on that board. Yet they claim it belongs to us. And the people are really hurt by what they do. And I don't know what has to be done to turn these things around for our younger people. Today, our younger people are very discouraged with Sea Alaska. You see it in Seattle. You see it all across Alaska. They're discouraged with the fact that you do not get you don't get your college grants. You have to go to the state of Alaska. Most of our students have to go to the state of Alaska to get a state loan to go to college. And they're not guaranteed any jobs when they come back home to work in their corporation. That's about all, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Yeah.
Good evening.
Justice Berger, I appreciate the opportunity to speak here today. My name is Theodore Ted Borbridge, and I'm a shareholder of Sea Alaska and Chiatica, the regional and village corporations as formed under the ANSCA Bill of 1971. The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, or ANSCA as it is more commonly known, did a number of things within and without the Native community. From within, it created a certain amount of confusion. The Act states that the Native community, in order to benefit from the Act, shall form into a for-profit corporation or corporations. The corporations and the board of directors, upon formal organization, became subject to the Securities Exchange Commission. The rules and regulations of this entity were, and to some degree still are, alien to the Native culture and method of doing things. The Act on passage took the Native community and literally threw them into the American mainstream, and it was a situation of sink or swim. Not being familiar with the American business systems and or methods, we swallowed a lot of water learning to swim. Fortunately, we're learning. The influx of large sums of money to the individuals as distributed by the Alaska Native Fund were beyond comprehension and created a false sense of security, independence, and the feeling that we were in a possession of a bottomless well. Relating to the land, there came to the forefront at least four questions, and they were: where will the land be located? When will we receive the land? How soon can I select mine? And how large will the lots be? The impact of the Act outside the Native community was very negative. Questions asked were, why should they get all that land? Didn't we buy Alaska from the Russians? Why are they getting land and money? It should be one or the other, not both. All the Indian lands will be locked up. There won't be any hunting, any fishing, or trapping available if they are given this land. By what right do they receive all this land? The Native corporations as formed under ANSCA received what was at the time to be determined the best deal, or at best a compromise. The individual shareholder Renee had a closer relationship with the land than the corporate entity could realize. He also had the ability to change various situations as warranted. The corporations, although not insensitive to this situation, were not flexible due to the very nature of its structure. It may well behoove the native corporations to give some thought to finding and researching other alternatives as to the disposition of their lands. Consideration should be given to the mechanism of conveying lands to either the IRA or a village council, which could do or be in a better position to protect those lands. The issue of 1991 is a very valid concern. The stocks as issued to the shareholder in 1971 is to be recalled in 19 and new stock issued. This stock will be a negotiable commodity and could possibly sway the control of the native corporations, which in reality is the absolute control of the land. The framers of ANSCA did not envision the complex problems created by passage of the Act. To alleviate some of the major problems, such as taxation, possible loss of lands through sale of stock, the regional and village corporations should seek an extension of the 1991 clause. They should also seek to have the opportunity to enroll the children of shareholders born after 1971. These children have, for all practical and legal purposes, been disfranchised except through inheritance. As mentioned yesterday evening, the corporations are a mythical being, and the power of the corporation lies not within the board of directors, but within the shareholders. They and they alone determine the ultimate destiny of the corporation. For without this valuable resource, the Act is nothing more than another exercise in futility. And once again, I thank you for this opportunity. Thank you. And this is your copy. Yes, thank you.
Berger. Last night I spoke for the Sitka Community Association, and as I mentioned it, at that time I wanted to speak as a concerned shareholder. My name is William Brady, and I'm a shareholder of both Chattica Incorporated an urban corporation and Alaska, the regional corporation formed under the direction of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. I am full-blooded Tlingit Indian, born in Juneau, but raised in Sitka by my grandparents, Anna Cruz and Ida Jackson. I am married and I have 5 children and 7 grandchildren, so I am deeply concerned about what's coming about in 1991. My wife, Isabel Singh Brady, is a granddaughter of Peter Simpson, a Simpson Indian from Metlakatla, Alaska, and who is supposed to be one of the fathers of the land claims issue. I'd like to give you some of my background only because I feel it is probably pertinent to some of the things I'm about to say. I am a product of the BIA day schools and also the boarding school located at that time in Wrangell, Alaska, named Wrangell Institute. I graduated from that high school in 1940. I served in the Army of the United States from 1943 through mid-1946. I served in Alaska, in the South 48, in the China-Burma-India Theater. I bring this out only because quite often there are remarks stating that the Indians are not patriotic and particularly didn't care for the federal government. There have been many pictures taken by Merrill back in the early 1900s showing that the Alaska Native, particularly those in the southeastern area, are very, very, very patriotic. At any given time, you can see the flag of the United States flown from canoes that were coming or going from the Sitka Indian Village to campsites and or flying them on every occasion possible. My granddad, Anna Hoots, was located in the Klan house just above the where the Union Oil Station is now. And I can remember he and Bean and others talking late into the night. Unfortunately, he passed away while I was only 11 years old, but not having parents, as most young people in those days had, one of my uncles by the name of Casco took me in hand and took me out fishing, hunting to the traditional campgrounds within the Sitka area. So I'm basically familiar with the subsistence lifestyle. At the age of 9, I started fishing with an old Norwegian named John Fister and consequently fished with him until after World War II, and started in fishing with people in Sitka, such as Herman Kitka, who I sailed with for a number of years, and also Tom Young Sr. I was a board member on Shiataka Incorporated in the earlier years, and then had a hand in the organization of the Sitka Community Association in 1975, and have served as a council member or president since 1978 to the current date. I do have many personal concerns, not only about the land claims issue, but predating the inception of ANCSA by 100 years. The federal government, in many of our opinions, that is the Alaska Native, had a colonialism type rule in the state of Alaska. We have suffered much as Native people in the state of Alaska through the mismanagement of our welfare by the oldest bureaucracy within the federal government, that is the Bureau of Indian Affairs. There are some areas that the Bureau has helped us a lot, and there are other areas where they have failed miserably, such as Mr. Jacobs just talked about a little earlier this evening. One of the things we suffered a lot of was the Native Allotment Act, because of lack of information, no technical assistance from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And the other was the BIA Realty giveaway of the Sitka Indian Village. It was either under Governor Brady or Governor Swineford where the original site of the Sitka Indian Village extended from where this fish processing plant is down here to Swan Lake on the northern sector, and on the southern sector from the present location of the Sheffield Hotel, and again up to the Swan Lake area. And slowly, through mismanagement again by the Bureau and by the Realty Department, we subsequently lost all that land, and currently we're down to about 12 acres in the original Indian site down here. The other big thing that has bothered many of us here in Sitka is the fact that Mr. Jacobs mentioned earlier the Japonski Island complex was taken over by the Department of Defense, or the War Department at that time, starting in 1939. And telling us as Sitka Indians that when the war is over, we would get those lands back. This never happened. And through a little luck and a little foresight on the part of the Shiataka Incorporated, we were able to get top file on two little islands known as Ellis Island and Charcoal Island. And in cooperation with Shiataka, the Sitka Community Association was able to get some block grants to update the housing over there. So we're able to get that. Originally, that did belong to the Sitka Indian tribes, both the Raven and the Eagle clans. Parts of it were claimed specifically with campgrounds. And I can remember hauling herring eggs, some of which you had tonight, on branches, and hauling them up into trees there early in the spring so that we could dry them and put them away for the winter. Most recently, though, the Sierra Club has been instigating a bunch of lawsuits and other legal roadblocks in the path of the Sciatica selection of 23,000 acres over there. Mr. Jacob, Mr. Kitka, Mr. Borovich, myself, and others were involved in the selection of two basic sites over there. We moved away from the Hood Bay area, which was within 2 or 3 miles of Angoon, feeling that if we moved 20 or 30 miles north of there, that we would be out of the way, that we would in no way bother any of their traditional lifestyles. Currently, I don't have the exact figures, and just what I remember hearing Mr. Snippen say last night, that as of this reading last night, every Sciatica stockholder is now currently indebted, if we had to pay each of us out of our pockets, approximately $5,500 apiece. The end doesn't seem to be in sight. And 1991 is only 7 years away, and when we first heard about it, 20 years is a lot of time. The thing I would like to mention, and this has been mentioned earlier and I'll reiterate it, that because of our subsistence lifestyle for centuries, that we can't seem to count other than going back to the Second Ice Age, we have been subsistence-oriented people. We lived off the land. And all of a sudden, somebody in 1971 said, now you're going to have millions of acres and millions of dollars, and you've got to become corporate managers. My recollection of that, somewhere in 1972, and I can't remember the gentleman's name that gave us a crash course, 5 days of how to become corporate directors. The gentleman's first name was John. I can't remember his last name. John Fetters from a legal law firm in Washington, D.C. came up. He was 6'7". And I can remember he played with Marquette University as an all-star forward basketball player. He got up before us and looked at about 150 of us sitting in various corporations in the Gold Room and the Baranoff Hotel, and said, this is ridiculous. I don't see any bald-headed men. I don't see any fat people here. I don't see any $500 suits, and none of you smoke cigars, and I'm supposed to make corporate directors out of you. And I guess up to a certain point, he was right. The other thing that bothers me, and it bothers me considerably, is that having 7 grandchildren, I'm wondering at this point how we're going to handle 1991. Sea Alaska lost $29 million last year, and when a question was asked of the board of directors here in this room, what percentage was due to the fluctuating downgraded market of fish and timber? He said, well, of the $27 million, approximately 70% was due to the world markets. It became apparent to me then that the other $9 million must have been a fall of the board of directors, but nobody followed up on that. Basically, just for the information of my fellow stockholders, shareholders here, of the 16,000 members of Sea Alaska, our share of that loss was approximately $1,687 apiece. It's kind of mind-boggling when you think about it. And so far, coming December 21st of this year, we'll have been 13 years into our land selection process. We feel we have a legitimate reason to have it. We own it. And still we're in court. And we just lost another fight here the day before yesterday. These are things that I think about. These are things of legacy I have to hand to my grandchildren. Another thing that has bothered me plenty, and I speak of this only because I've been closely associated with it from both sides of the fence, and that's the alcohol and drug abuse rampant in the state of Alaska, and particularly in some of our high-level people who are making decisions for us in our regional corporations, and I'm sure quite often in our village corporations. It seems to me that with the influx of big money, and let's face it, the regional corporations, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, generated hundreds of million dollars of money floating around within the state of Alaska. Plus the fact, and I agree with Mark and others here, that one of the reasons that the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was pushed is, number one, to get the pipeline built, and number two, so that the state of Alaska can get their land selections. That hadn't moved anywhere since 1959. Immediately upon the enactment, a number of things began to happen. I don't know what the story is, but just statistically, the alcoholism rate within the Alaska Native is 10 times the national average. The alcoholism rate among the non-Indian in the state of Alaska is 4 times the national average. I worry quite often, and I've been... The non-native alcoholism rate in the state of Alaska is 4 times the national average, yes. I just got some figures the other day, and I'm not going to bore you with statistics, but it's astounding what has happened. I started to mention that the thing that worries me is the multi-million dollar deals made with regional corporations, financial institutions, and attorneys usually take place at a cocktail party, believe me. You can ask any of the corporate directors that are sitting around here. This is where the big business takes place. I sometimes looked at signatures and couldn't recognize my own, let alone other people. And still we make these kind of decisions. The same thing happens in Washington, D.C. I speak to it only because I've been involved, like as I am, both sides of the fence. And currently we're holding line on it. It's not getting any better, but through an effort of a lot of people, it's not getting worse. The last thing I want to mention, and this has been mentioned time and again, that subsistence is a way of life. It's a lifestyle. It doesn't matter whether I make $30,000 or $40,000 a year, I still want to get out there and do those things that my forefathers did before me. And I think it's something given to me by them, that through their efforts, I'm able to go out there and I'm able to catch fish, hunt, do clam digging. A lot of it, of course, now I can get out there in 20 minutes rather than 2 days of rowing, which I did a lot of. And this has been taken away of us even prior to the Native Claims Settlement Act. Bay after bay after bay was closed to us. I listened to Mr. Kitka, and one of the things he brought to my mind, and in the last few days I've been thinking about it, is that those bays that were closed by the Alaska Department of Fish and the Federal Fish and Game Commissions absolutely died out. Prior to that, the natives of Alaska fished those areas in a subsistent lifestyle and managed to keep those rivers clean enough for the fish to come in and spawn. But once they closed it off to us, those streams died. And I can name bays. Herman told me about Black Bay. That died completely off when they closed that bay. Redoubt with the Sockeye streams, when they closed that bay, it almost died. It's slowly coming back. There are many, many other streams. Aquaculture, yes, definitely. Mr. Kitka has done that in Deep Bay, and he's brought that back to life on his own. He was practicing it before the fishing game even thought of it. So my thinking is subsistence is a lifestyle that is being slowly taken away from us. I think it's something that's very important to us. We don't want to lose that. These are just little notes here, Justice Berger, and I won't give it to you, seeing it's on tape. I thank you for the opportunity to speak.